So any questions or comments? Yes.
About cultivating these four qualities that we have been talking about. I've been doing lots of metta and some mudita also. And I noticed that sometimes they bring up this feeling or bodily sensation. And then when that comes up, I can drop the phrases and just be with that bodily sensation of that quality. But sometimes that does not appear. But I still can go on sort of cultivating. So like the cultivation goes on, but there's a different result every time. But still, you know, it seems to me that we cannot abandon the result. We cannot be neglecting the result, that it's not important, the result. I think, like, if we are cultivating loving kindness, the purpose of that thing is the result, to be loving and kind. So, like, what are we trying to do here? What is the result? Or are we targeting something? What is this about?
Okay, I think it's very important to see that, in a way, you could see in terms of result, you have in a way, you could say, two different ones. There is the result, the effect of actually using either the quality or using any other object of mindfulness and cultivating, anchoring, and looking deeply, purposefully. And that will have an effect. And to me, in a way, this is the most important effect, because I think it's a de-grasping effect of just whatever you do, you anchor and you explore together. So that will have its own effect of doing that, of coming back to the phrases, of coming back to the breath, of coming back to the question. Then it is true, I feel that each technique will have a little different effect. But the effect, again, might have two different aspects, in terms that you might experience the effect there and then, or you don't experience the effect there and then, but later on in your daily life, you will experience the effect. So you can have what I would call an immediate effect, and you can have a later on effect. So in terms of the effect, immediate in terms of the meditation, that is, you could say, according to the conditions. Because it's like, I don't know, you might have a favorite dish you really like, and yes, I love this dish. And generally, when you eat the dish, you have a pleasant feeling too. But let's say you're really feeling ill, and you're really feeling exhausted, and the dish is the same, but the dish will not have the same effect. Because, in a way, you could nearly say the feeling tone is a bit low, so it cannot bring it back to the same place. So I think we have to be careful here that with the same ingredient might not create the same effect every time because of other conditions that comes in. But so of course, when we have the immediate effect, it's very pleasant, because we feel, oh yes, this is really working. But personally, I would see it slightly as a sideline, slightly as a kind of a, you could nearly say, extra benefit. That even if you don't have that extra benefit of really experiencing over time that loving kindness, the fact that you focus on it orients you toward that. And over time, this also has an effect. So personally, I kind of look at the, in terms of effect, the three different aspects. The effect of just doing the anchoring and the looking deeply, which have its own effect, which is generally subtle, but then become activated more in daily life. Then the effect here and now, which I think we do get, but it's not permanent. So it comes, and to see it as a gift in a way. Oh, that's nice. This time I experience it. Another time you might not, another time again you experience it. And then also looking, personally I think this cultivating these four qualities is actually orienting us toward, it's kind of like building up the intention, building up the possibility. Because if we think, oh yeah, loving kindness is a possibility, compassion is a possibility, rejoicing is a possibility, equanimity is a possibility. Actually, we give a little power to the potential of that. And then later on, it's more likely to be activated, again, considering the different circumstances. And I'll talk more about this tonight, actually, in terms of those things.
May I ask just like, is it then wise to anchor to the immediate effect? Because I do that quite often.
But that's fine.
If it's impermanent and all that, is it like stable anchoring?
Yeah, I mean, if it's there in the experience, in a way, it's nearly that you don't need to do anything. Because often when this thing happens, when you have what I would call a meditative state or a kind state or whatever state it might be, equanimous state, it's very hard to say it is happening because I did this. I mean, we generally think it is happening because I did this. But actually, many things came together for us to experience it. And so personally, I would see it more as a state of de-grasping, of state of just experiencing in that moment kindness, a certain type of kindness, because in that moment we're not grasping at anything. Nothing is stopping the kindness from manifesting. That's the way I would look at it more. That actually the grasping goes and then the kindness can be there. And then the compassion. And of course, if we do the loving kindness, it can orient us that way. But I have experienced a state of loving kindness without doing the loving kindness. So it's not necessarily immediately connected to just the phrases. Because if you sit in meditation, do the questioning or do some other technique, you can have a moment of de-grasping in which you feel love for everybody. And actually the love comes from the de-grasping, more than from the orienting toward that, because it's a possibility within us. And so personally what I would say that when you experience something like that it be loving kindness or equanimity or whatever else, then in a way you could nearly say the anchor happened by itself. Because the state itself is just all pervasive. It's there. And then you don't have to do anything apart from being with the state, accompanying the state, which is interesting because through that it sustains itself. But like all things, it's impermanent. So then at some point, actually what is interesting is you can help yourself to be with the state, to sustain the state, just by being with it without grasping or rejecting. But then at some point, the energy of that goes. And in a way, it cannot be sustained in the same way. Then after, often you have just more like a kind of a little faint wisp of it, a little thing left, but it's not as obvious. So yeah, to anchor in it is fine, because it's there. It's in the experience. And in being with it, in a way you benefit from it because it enables you to experience yourself differently. To me, that's actually more than the effect of it, that it's nice to feel loving and kind. What I found important is to experience, I can feel this. And that kind of shift a little the perspective, if you have a tendency to think, I cannot feel this, or I cannot experience this. Yes?
You talked today about compassion and suffering. Do you have some advice? There is a lot of suffering in the world, and I'm at this job where I can't close my eyes. I work at grassroots. With these people, and I see the suffering, and that's the suffering, I think, is because of there's a lot of greed, and a lot of greed. So, of course, I'm sad because of the people are suffering, but mainly I'm angry. Can you give some advice? Is it compassion or other things that can help with the anger?
Yeah, because you see, I think, as I mentioned before, you have anger as a creative function. That anger, its creating function is actually to make us act and to, you know, right wrongs, you could say. Like many years ago, I saw somebody in France who was very instrumental of helping homeless people. He was one of the first person in the 50s who did things for the homeless and really put it out there, l'Abbé Pierre. And what was interesting at that conference, he was saying, I am angry. I am angry at poverty. I am angry at homelessness. And so because he was angry at that, it did not make him angry in terms of becoming aggressive, but it made him efficacious in terms of finding creative way to make a difference to the condition. So he even became a member of parliament, and so that he could be more in the public eye. He did many different things. And so because he was angry, he used that anger in a creative way, which then could have beneficial result. Because otherwise you can have like what I would call a misguided anger, which then turn on yourself and turn on others, and which can then become aggressive, and then you have people who seem to have lots of good intention, but they're treating the people around them very nastily. Sometimes it happens. You know, you're working for the homeless, but you're very nasty to the person you work with to help the homeless. It's kind of strange, that. So I think here we have to see, I think one of the important things, if we are working with suffering, we're very close to it, like if you are a social worker, or you nurse, or you help the refugee, or many different aspects, you have to see that, yes, there is lots of suffering, but also there are lots of people trying to creatively engage with the suffering. To me, that's what really inspires me, to see people at all kind of circumstances really, in a way, making a difference at their level. To me, that's what is important. And then, of course, you can see that the suffering is due to big forces, you could say. Greed for power, greed for money, in many different kind of people being selfish, and et cetera, et cetera. But here, in a way, we have to accept this external condition in a creative way. Because we could be either resentful or resigned. But because there are these big forces which we have not much action on, it doesn't mean at the small level we cannot do something for the people around us. So to me, that's what we have to be careful about. Because the anger and the powerlessness might make us think, oh, we cannot do anything. When actually, at our level, what is important is, how do I relate to my coworker? How I relate to the people who are suffering? How do I relate to myself? So in a way, trying to then have the compassion for yourself, the people you work with, the people you work for. And at the same time, seeing that there are limits, that there are limits of your time, of your finances, of your energy, so that you also have to be compassionate for yourself. And so I think sometimes the compassion I see as being on a spectrum. Sometimes you have more compassion for others, sometimes you have more compassion for yourself, and sometimes you are in the middle. But within that, we need to have the wisdom, the kind of the creative wisdom of how to be with suffering. How much can I be with suffering? Sometimes you have to move away from it because it's too much. Because the fact that when we are with suffering, we experience unpleasant feeling tone. And there is only so much we can have of that. And that's why the element of equanimity, of stability, of balance is so important. How can I be with suffering? Then I need also to cultivate mudita, so I can also be with the suffering. That is not suffering all the time. That there is not just suffering around us. So it's kind of looking at the different elements. Yes?
I just have a small question about the reflection, actually. During these days, at many times, I feel like I connect to the same place or same mind state as when I was a child, and the world looks the same, like from a, and I was just wondering, is there some notion that maybe in the Buddhism or in your experience that that somehow we've been there before as children seeing the world, because it's so striking, it really feels like I'm being pulled back to that very same place, like how the tree looks and how the, so it's a recognition, that's what I mean. So I'm just wondering.
Yes and no. Mm-hmm. Yes, in the level of there is a certain wonderment. There is a certain wonderment, there is a certain immediacy, there is a certain exploring. You know, like with children, sometimes they'll just ask the same question, not because they want an answer, because they enjoy questioning. You know, just the questioning itself is fun. And also because you question, you look at the thing itself, and you have a relationship. So at that level, yeah, there is a little of something which is very similar. Then you are, when you are a child, and you marvel, and you question, and you wonder. And at the same time, we have to be careful to idealize too much the state of being a child. Because what you can see very clearly with a very young baby is that actually children are grasping machine, you know? They're really powerful grasping machine because they need to survive. We need to survive. That's why we grasp, to survive. And so I think, in a way, in the child, we can see the two aspects, which is still within us. Of course, it's still within us. The possibility to be astonished, to open, to marvel, to wonder, to ask questions. And at the same time, together with that, this impulse to survive, the impulse to grab, the impulse to have for ourselves. So that's why often it's very funny with the parents and the children. Like often the parents encourage the children to share, you know, and then sometimes you see the child doesn't want to share. And then all the time the child naturally wants to share. It's very interesting to see when you have these two movements that naturally the child will give it to you just as a means to connect with you, to give you something. And then all the time, no way, it's mine. So I think, yes, it can bring us back to a certain kind of openness, that one can have as a child, of course. It's often mentioned. Yes?
I'm not sure if I can formulate this question, but I will try. You were talking about daydreaming yesterday and how it's so nice sometimes, but I started thinking about it and I noticed that we also daydream. I'm not sure if it's daydream, but we formulate these not so pleasant scenarios in our head. And I started thinking how absurd that is, because they can be very elaborate, horrible things. So I'm just wondering, why do we do that?
I think you have a different mental habit, mental pattern, which all comes from creative functioning. And so I would say with the daydreaming, the association is a pleasant feeling tone. So you have a pleasant feeling tone and you go into this nice, wonderful daydream kind of film. But we know also that people like to go and see romantic movie and very happy movie. But it seems lots of people like to see a horror movie. You know, I mean, recently with my husband, we went to see a movie. I thought it was a detective story. I thought, in Korea, detective story, why not? And then we both realized that it was a horror movie, a Korean horror movie. We're like, huh? Because we never go and watch these things. But people go and watch them, because again, there is a connection with the unpleasant. So what I would call that is rumination. And then that's very interesting. As you say, rumination right here, right now, I'm okay. But then, if you look at what I call negative rumination, and then you can go into really like, you have either the rumination where you plot revenge, or you have what I call negative fantasy, where you sit there and you make this huge, terrible scenario. I mean, once I was teaching, and there was this lady who was crying. And so we were worried about her. And then later on, she told us that the whole afternoon, she was doing negative fantasy on her cat. My cat is dying. My cat is dying without me. This is terrible. Well, actually, the cat was fine. And so, but if you look, generally, you're sitting here, you're okay. And then suddenly, a little unpleasant feeling tone arises in connection to a word, in connection to an image, in connection to something in the past, or in connection to something in the future. It generally starts out as just this little unpleasant contact which arises, but then you grasp at it. And then by grasping at it, then you go into this huge story around it. And so personally, what I find what can be useful with this kind of negative fantasy is to be careful at the beginning, to notice what is it that suddenly orient me that way. And then I can't stop thinking kind of this terrible scenario, and if this happened and that happened. And I mean, I used to do this with my husband when I got married long ago. I would sit in meditation and then I would think, oh, but what if he dies, you know? And then I would have all kind of, you know, and then I would come out of the meditation, and he would say, what's the matter? And I thought, this is weird. He's not dead yet. What do I imagine this all the time? And then in order, and I could see it was a little unpleasant feeling tone, which then would fixate it on that storyline. And then I thought of a creative way to stop doing that. And instead of starting to think, what if he dies? I started to bring, what if I die? And then I really could not care less what happened. And then it stopped. I stopped doing that. So I think it's kind of like seeing what is it about, which is interesting, And secondly, to look how did it start, and then how can I creatively nearly turn it round? Yeah?
Did somebody translate rumination?
So it's like a cow which chew and chew and chew. So yeah, I think
the question was like, why we do that?
Oh, why we do is because we can. I think this is one of the reasons. Because we can, and mainly because we grasp at the unpleasant. But then we can do it for what is interesting is we can do it for many different reasons, this negative thing. Sometimes it's because we frighten yourself and it comes more out of anxiety. But sometimes it's a weird magical thinking. If I think bad things, they're not going to happen. You know, so it's kind of as a mean to kind of like, you know, protect. I mean, it's interesting to look because the function is to reflect. The function is to reflect on what has happened. The function is also to imagine. Sometimes it's useful to imagine. But then if it becomes a habit, then I think we can notice there are different interpretations, different kind of like little reasoning causes behind it. And so a little bit, I think what can help us with the meditation, do I need to think about this now? I think it's kind of like if you keep thinking negatively about something, because often you just frighten yourself more and more. Because although, as you said, we think that if the more we think about something, the more we go into solve it. When personally I think it's the opposite. The more we think about something, the less we are creative with it. And so I think what the meditation can help us is actually to create space so that we think about it time to time. If we have something on the mind, we want to imagine a certain scenario. We think about it a little bit every day. I would say for 20, 30 minutes. But then after that, you leave it for the rest of the day. You live your life. Then again, the next day, you think about it again. And then you leave it. And what happens is that then within ourselves, our own creative potential has a space to develop. And then over time, suddenly, oh yeah, you have in a way a solution or you have a decision. And so I think the meditation helps us to see that sometimes not thinking is actually thinking, but in a different way. Yeah?
Yeah, I had a question. They said that you become what you think all day long. So how should one do that without grasping? Because now when you have talked about grasping here, kind of start to think, well, ain't that grasping if I kind of choose something that I want to think about and manifest in myself or to myself in my life? So
if you do it without grasping and that something will happen, you see, it's kind of how much time do you spend in it and do you grasp at it must happen? Or is it that there is some possibility, there are some choices, and so you want to think a little about it. And so it might make it happen or not. Because you see, we think about things, but we think about things in a way slightly in abstraction because it's inside our head. And we don't have generally all the elements, the people, the situation. So you might have a great idea, and then you try to apply it, and then if everything comes together, it will work. And then if everything doesn't come together, you could have the best idea, and it might not work. And so if it's kind of he's seeing it as a possibility, so that, yes, I can think a little bit about this, but being careful to invest everything in it, but just to see it as an exploration. Because when they say that's what you think you become, There it's more in term, I think, partly, that it's what you're going to say and act. So, you know, if you plot revenge, then that's what's going to kind of possibly happen, because you work on it. They're terrible. And you don't see any other thing. When they might have difficulty, but there might be some good point which you could maybe access. So it's more looking at that. If we are just like a mono way of thinking, then we're going to start to speak a certain way, act a certain way. And so kind of looking at the consequences, but also looking at the feeling tone. If I think about this, what's the feeling tone, and then what does it lead me to? So it's kind of looking at the different aspects. And then we have to go on it.